Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to this evening's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Paul Clark, a member of the Asia Pacific Forum of the club, and I'm chair for today's panel, Remembering Afghan Women, with Catherine Brown and Olga Oliker. We have two great speakers. Catherine Brown is pursuing a PhD at Columbia. She is a former communications advisor at the U.S. Embassy in Kabul, Afghanistan, a former White House staffer, and a former director of communications at the Asia Foundation. And Olga Oliker, our other speaker, is a senior international policy analyst at the RAND Corporation. She's an expert in security sector creation and reform in the context of broader political and economic development. She's done extensive work on the ground in places like Afghanistan, Iraq, and Liberia, some very, very tough places. And she's written on security and the impact on Afghan women. And so this topic is very familiar to her. And I could go on talking about these two women. They're associated with a few groups I want to mention who are sponsoring this event. There's the Asia Foundation, where Catherine used to work, the Asia Society of Northern California, and the Truman National Security Project Educational Institute. And both of our speakers are members of that third group. But I shall go on, and I'll have our first speaker, Catherine Brown, come up and speak to you. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Paul. I'm honored to be here with Olga this evening to discuss this very important topic, which is due in part to the Time magazine recent cover story creeping back into our national discourse on the war and our future role in Afghanistan. Wars are difficult to be dispassionate about, but the Afghanistan war is further complicated by the question of human rights and the future of minorities and women. And with this war, there's definitely the facet of security. There's the debate over what a troop presence can achieve. And then there's the issue of principle. There's those who believe that we have an obligation to keep the promises we made after 2001 to provide long-term stability and prosperity. And there's those who believe that war can never be principled. But in recent history, there's been no other country like Afghanistan where gender equity and women's rights have been at the forefront in nation-building and peacemaking efforts. There's a very real moral dilemma here, and women are often used as a symbol for both sides of the debate, why troops should stay and why we should go. So I'm going to do and speak to what I know best, which is my seven-year history with Afghanistan. I first arrived there in November 2003. So I'm going to talk about the status of women in Afghanistan, past and present, the perceptions of this issue from Afghan women in Afghanistan, and third, the issue of security and logistics for practical development in the country, including women's empowerment. So first, on the status of Afghan women, I wanted to give you some statistics to frame their situation today. With education, 85.1% of women have no formal education, and nearly 79% of Afghan women are illiterate. And 74% of girls usually drop out before the fifth grade. And in some areas, in rural areas, only 1% of girls attend school. With the economy, the average salary for women is about 48 cents a day. And regarding health, women's overall life expectancy is approximately 45 years old, and women give birth to an average of 7 children. And last, with security, this is very disturbing, as 80% of women are affected by domestic violence. Over 60% of marriages are forced, and half of all girls are married before the age of 16. So violence against women also can result in self-immolation, suicide, forced prostitution, and drug addiction. So since the intervention in 2002, there's been some improvement in the quality of Afghan women's lives. The first, women constitutionally have rights and are equal with men. Women and girls can attend school, they can work, they can leave their homes, depending on where they're located and the traditional values their family may have. And they're not mandated, you know, it's not law to wear a burqa to be covered. Over 400 women have registered to run for the upcoming parliamentary elections, which is a sign that women are becoming more politically active. And the Afghan constitution does have an explicit reference that there needs to be 25% quota of women in parliament. With health, there's been some improvements. infant mortality rate has declined by 25%, and the number of women receiving prenatal care from a skilled birth attendant has increased by 300%. But still, those services are only available to about 20% of Afghan women. So the most progress for Afghan women was seen in the last century. There's a myth that women in Afghanistan have known only oppression. But in the 1960s and 70s, Afghanistan was arguably more progressive than many of its Muslim neighboring countries. Afghan urban women were attending universities, they were working as doctors, nurses, and professors. And women accounted for as many as 70% of teachers and approximately 50% of civil servants, 50-50. So it's a remarkable contribution they made to Afghan society. And 20th century leaders, most notably Amanullah Khan and Mohammad Daoud, they saw women's rights as a central symbol of modernity. And they challenged hardline mullahs to really cite any verses of the Quran, which specifically mandated that women be confined to their homes and make them wear the veil. So no such evidence was ever found, so these practices were deemed voluntary. But starting in 1992, as the country found civil war and Soviets pulled out and the U.S. Had abandoned or suspended its diplomatic mission in 1989, women's rights to participate in social, economic, cultural, and political life were drastically cut by fundamentalists. And during the Taliban era, as we all know, women did not have the rights to work, to travel, they didn't have rights to health care, legal recourse, recreation, and basically the right to being human. This was barbaric, and in areas where the Taliban has resurged, women continue to be subject to violence and intimidation, which we read about almost weekly now. So there isn't much argument that women in Afghanistan deserve a better quality of life and that helping progress move forward is really the right thing to do. So what can be done? This summer I spent 5 weeks in the country for research, and I was mainly interviewing Afghans. And I wanted to share some findings from a report Women for Women International did about Afghan women's levels of optimism, which are very high and largely consistent with what I found in my own experiences with the women I worked with in the past 7 years. In this report, they say that about 84% of women, or almost 84% of women, describe the overall situation for women and girls in country right now as good as or very good. And 84.8% were optimistic about the future of Afghanistan. So this starkly contrasts with the general gloom of and about the country. And the women that I know and have spoken with by far focus on the opportunities that are available to them and that they're hoping will continue to be available to them. The opportunities in small businesses, journalism, education, and politics. And also, you know, in the police and the army and the national security forces that are being built. But they all emphasize the need to stay committed to Afghanistan so that the opportunities can continue but also become more mainstream. These are really concentrated at the moment in more urban areas. And they all acknowledge that things take a lot of time. It's going to take a lot of time to really gain the gravitas that they need, especially in political life and in parliament. And one woman parliamentarian said that, you know, we need some time for women to prove that they can do things. They see this as being a very short time span the past 8 years to really prove what they're able to do. The men that I speak with are far more focused on what July 2011 will mean for the international community's commitment to Afghanistan and how they can and will survive if there is a significant troop drawdown before Afghan security forces are ready, or if a deal with the Taliban is made as part of reconciliation and reintegration. Women, while much more optimistic, are concerned about this as well. They're caught between the war and the idea of Taliban reconciliation to bring peace. This is a horrible trade-off for them. Women largely want security. In the same Women for Women International report, 66% of women interviewed said that the first problem that should be fixed is the security situation. And women support a negotiated end to the conflict to bring that peace and security, but are concerned that the Taliban gain a share of national power or govern whole districts or provinces as part of an agreement, the consequences will be dire. Afghan women groups like Women for Afghan Women, Revolutionary Association of Women of Afghanistan, and Afghan Women's Network have major concerns about a hasty exit or quick reconciliation. And Samira Hamidi, the executive director of the Afghan Women's Network, said specifically that, you know, because women suffer the most during war and they're such a vulnerable population, they don't oppose reintegration and reconciliation with the Taliban. They acknowledge that you need a political deal to bring this war to a close. But if it's going to be done overnight, she says, in quote, then of course things will get worse for Afghan women. I agree that we need to be realistic about what reconciliation with Taliban leadership will mean. There's few people who think that they will keep their word, especially if a deal is not made under duress. The Taliban is an ideological movement, and their leaders believe in the brutality that they execute. A lot of people cite, and Human Rights Watch points this example as well, that in 2008, Pakistan negotiated a settlement with the Taliban and gave it control of the Swat Valley, but in exchange for pledges to recognize the central government and let women work without fear. The Taliban broke those promises, women were whipped, schools were torched, and the Pakistani army had to go back in and launch a military operation to take back the Swat. So there's the argument that Afghan women need more development aid from the United States and not troops. And it's true, troops can't be there forever, and they shouldn't be. But we want diplomacy and aid work not just from the U.S. government, from the thousands of NGO workers and charity workers that operate in Afghanistan to continue. And you really have to be inside of Afghanistan to believe the conditions. Everything there takes time, not just because of poor security, but poor mobility, because of the traffic and lack of infrastructure, the heat in some areas, the altitude and the cold in other areas, the dust that's everywhere, and the corruption. They all speak to the complicated logistics and practicalities of peace and development. And counterinsurgency strategy, or COIN, which we hear about so much, the reason for the troop increase, the COIN strategy focuses on infrastructure and governance development and expanding the writ of the Afghan government and the constitution, which includes ensuring women's rights. COIN is ideally supposed to be civilian-led, but civilians, specifically the State Department and USAID, which has over 1,000 State Department USAID officials there at the moment, they don't traditionally have the resources or the capacity to do what our military can in this environment. So what will change the course of this war, I believe, is the provision of security. It's the cornerstone of progress in human development. It's what Afghan women want. And for international development systems to continue, development workers need it as well. And so without security and mobility, there's very little that they can do. And one example, and we'll speak to this probably later, is you see in Iraq, yes, we have 58,000 combat troops pulling out, but simultaneously for the State Department to continue its work, they have to rely on security contractors, and they're about to double how many people there work to ensure mobility and security for them. So we'll address more in the questions, but in closing, this is indeed a very real moral dilemma and one that I feel deeply, having been a woman who's worked there in different capacities for the past 7 years. I'm impatient after spending so many years there, but I'm also frustrated about how U.S. policy has unfolded until recently. Before the Taliban resurgence in 2005 and 2006, many women saw their basic rights denied to them under the Taliban restored. They went to work, they sent their daughters to school, they voted, ran for office, and women are continuing to do that today. But in areas where the Taliban has resurged, those rights have been under attack again. But the women that I know who live with this every day and have patience, they have incredible patience. They don't want to be given up on. They appreciate the sacrifices that international community has made, and they do want to get to the stage where troops are not needed. They don't want war, but they also fear very much the return of the Taliban and a hasty exit. So this is a long-term effort which aid and development workers should have the lead on. In the meanwhile, the international community should ensure that development aid reaches women, while simultaneously the Afghan government needs to adhere to its international commitments and address violence against women and improve access to health and education. The Afghan government also needs to ensure that women play a key role in this peace-building process every step of the way, and Karzai needs to see through his pledge that women will play a substantive role in the High Council for Peace, which will see to any reconciliation reintegration process with the Taliban. We've been myopic with Afghanistan in years past, and we shouldn't be so again now, I believe. A negotiated end to this war will likely be necessary, but women's rights should not be negotiable. If we want a responsible exit, women's empowerment should not come second to security, and their rights definitely should not be sacrificed for peace. Progress for Afghan women is possible. It's within their constitution and also within the context of Islam. And Afghan culture is not immutable. Sustainable development, though, can only be done with the participation of women and movements towards gender equity, which Olga will speak more to. But all of this will take time, and we need to ensure that the conditions are there for aid and development to work.
Thank you, Catherine Brown. And now Olga Olaker.
All right, so I get my little booster stand since I'm told that some of you could not see, so hopefully you can see and hear. First, I want to thank everyone for being here today. I want to thank the Commonwealth Club for hosting us, all these organizations for sponsoring, and Paul for organizing, and also Catherine for joining me on this panel. Really appreciate it. So I'm going to build on what Catherine has said. I think she gave a really excellent overview. And I'm going to start by saying, look, there are two big arguments out there for why it's important to do something to care about the empowerment of Afghan women. And one is the one that Catherine made, which is, look, it's the right thing to do. If you don't, if this isn't important, then it's a huge group of people who are denied their human rights, their very basic human rights, systematically, every day, and it's going to continue to go on. As a country, as individuals, it's not the sort of thing that we should just sit by and watch. The other argument is an instrumental one. What it says is, you know, we don't always do the right thing, right? But sometimes there are things you do because they work. And the way that argument goes is if women aren't empowered, everything else falls apart. That Afghanistan's development and security are hampered if women don't play a larger role in that society and that economy. And if that happens, then Afghanistan's chances for security are worse, and that hurts us because Afghanistan is important to the region is important to the United States, and seriously, if you don't think Afghanistan is important, then, you know, think back to September 11th. You know, you can argue a lot of countries had nothing to do with it, but you really can't argue that the Taliban had nothing to do with it. So I don't think there's much argument on the first one. I think most of us will agree that it's the right thing to do. But I think the second one is worth unpacking, because this concept of empowering women, it's been around for a long time, that it leads to development, that it improves security, and it's gotten a whole lot of currency lately, in part thanks to a book that came out this last year by Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudun, titled Half the Sky. And they make this argument. And the obvious response you get to this argument is, okay, really? Because a lot of countries, including our own, have developed fairly effectively without full equality for women. So really, is it necessary? And the answer is, you're right, they did. But if you really think about it, and you think about some of the countries that have empowered their women and how they've done, if you look at the experience of Communist China, or the Soviet Union, countries which did not give women full equality by any means, but did a much better job of harnessing their economic and political power. And even if you do look at our own history and think about the times when women have been more instrumental, think about the settlement of the West, think about World War II when all those women went into the workforce, you realize that we do better when we can draw on the full wealth of human potential in this country. And what's interesting is when you look at the theoretical research, in developing countries especially, there is a growing wealth of information that suggests that countries do develop better when women and girls have political and economic power and rights. Specifically, some things happen in poor countries. When women are earning money, not just working, women work everywhere, but when they're earning money, they tend to have fewer children. What does that mean? That means that the ratio of people working to people dependent on them goes up, and that tends to help a country's development. Another thing, women are, in developing countries, more likely than men to reinvest the money they earn in their families, to pay for their children's health care, to pay for education, to focus on things of that sort. And on the macro level, women who are in power, who are in government positions, tend to spend money on things that benefit communities more than men do. They tend to spend money on wells in communities that don't have access to water, for example, and convince their male counterparts to do so where they might not have done it otherwise. Another thing that happens when women are in power in developing countries is that their presence in government and police institutions is correlated with reductions in corruption. And corruption is one of the biggest things holding back countries in the developing world. In a conflict or a post-conflict society, in a country that's in the middle of war or coming out of war, all of these things are magnified. Why? Well, in a war, in any kind of war, men are going to die, and they're going to die disproportionately. That means that you're going to have, or they're going to be disabled, you're going to have a lot of female-headed households. If women can't work, if they haven't been prepared to work, if they can't provide for their families, those families are going to be even poorer than they would be otherwise. Inequitable societies, whether they're inequitable to women or to minorities or to any group, are just more prone to conflict. Just as statistical correlations demonstrate that the less equality, the more likely it is that there will be conflict. And more equitable societies have higher living standards and just less political violence. And what's really interesting is analysis that didn't set out to do this, but that was looking at these correlations, found that there was an independent relationship between peace and female empowerment. So even set aside the fact that societies that have more women in power have better standards of living, throw out the standard of living. Societies that have more women in power just have more peace. So, you know, we actually have a government right now that recognizes these things. We have a Secretary of State that has made the empowerment of women globally a large part of her platform. It's something she speaks about. It's something she clearly believes in. And when you look at U.S. policy in Afghanistan, if you look at the policy documents, the right things are there. The empowerment, the advancing of the rights of women and girls, it's right there in the State Department strategies and U.S. government strategies. It's a component of all sorts of efforts. The police building effort in Afghanistan, there is an emphasis on recruiting women. There's an emphasis on building domestic violence response teams. Catherine talked about the tremendous levels of domestic violence in Afghanistan. It's all in there. Education efforts, literacy training targets women, healthcare. Catherine talked about some of the advances that we've seen in Afghanistan. It targets women and children. Training in agricultural programs, a lot of it is focused on women, efforts to strengthen traditional artisanal activities, training people, getting them access to markets. But what happens in practice? And a lot of this is harder than it looks, and it's some of what Catherine was saying. Things take longer in Afghanistan. We've all heard about the attacks on schools where girls go to school. I think we're all aware of that. But even with other programs, a lot of it is a matter of reach. So we have just a couple of photographs. Let's see if I can do this. That is a picture of Helmand, Helmand Province. It's got some British forces moving through. It's a picture I found on the internet. My picture's all taken through the backs, you know, in the backs of heavily armored vehicles, and they tend not to look that good. This is Jalalabad. Afghanistan is not one country in terms of development. So if you live in Kabul and you're a woman, odds are pretty decent that if you need to get around, you can get around. You have reasonable amount of access to education. If you live in Jalalabad, drive through Jalalabad, you see girls going to school. Less access than Kabul, not as good. If you go to some other towns and villages, it's more mixed. You go to Helmand, nobody has anything. Nobody has any kind of access. People talk about Afghanistan being in the 13th or 14th century. That's what they mean. They don't mean Jalalabad, right? So when you think about how you develop these programs, how do you develop them so they can target people in all of Afghanistan's levels of development? So what happens, for example, is you have a literacy program. You have money to give out to train people to read and write. You hire a local NGO to implement it. That local NGO is run by educated, intelligent people. They come from major cities. That means that they're going to implement it. They're going to move a little further outside of their comfort range. But they're not going to get there. Oh, sorry. They're going to get there. They're not going to get there. It's hard. It's dangerous. You can't, you know, Afghan young people who sign up to do literacy training don't want to go there either. So a lot of what happens with a lot of these programs is it's not that they don't help, but they help people that it's easier to access than the people who might need it the most. And the same thing with agricultural training programs, right? It's a great idea, but unless they're very carefully designed, in a lot of Afghan communities, women aren't allowed to go to market to sell things. A man has to do it for them, or sometimes an older woman, a widow, can do it. That's not the case in all. I mean, Afghan is diverse. different communities have very different standards. But if you're working with a community like this, you need to build this in to your program. Otherwise, they're going to lose a chunk of the money that they're supposed to get because they have to pay this person. So this can be done, and I think there are a lot of people in the development field who are aware of it and who are building this in. But when you think about your expectations and trying to figure out how programs can be developed, these are the things that have to be built in, and you have to understand how difficult it can be to access the people who need help the most. So these are the things that you can fix in sort of technocratic ways. Understand it better, you can resolve it. I don't think that the greatest danger to the women of Afghanistan is agricultural programs needing better design. You know, when you recognize they need better design, you fix the design. I think the biggest problem is an argument that you hear over and over again that Catherine alluded to, which suggests that security has to come first, that women's rights and empowerment, they're important, but you've got to have the security before you can worry about these things. And this argument, it takes many forms, and it manifests itself in many ways in Afghanistan. One is reconciliation, which Catherine talked about. And aside from the fact that you're dealing with groups that oppose rights for women, you're turning a blind eye in some of these efforts to actual real-life abuses. You are working with people who have child brides, who might have taken boys as catamites. These are really, this is child sexual abuse, right? It's not acceptable in most of our societies. But you got to make a deal with this guy. So what are you going to do? You're going to call him on the fact that his wife is 13? You're not. And so by doing this, by not integrating these beliefs into our broader efforts, we help perpetuate the system. The other thing you see is law and order. Right, the courts in Afghanistan are not widespread. They're not trusted. The low literacy levels in the country make it really difficult to get judges and prosecutors and other attorneys out. So people turn to a variety of different forms of justice. And in the U.S., the development community has, this is very much the flavor of the day, is traditional justice. How can we empower traditional justice? How can we plug it into the formal system? Well, here's the thing about traditional justice. First, there's any number of different systems. But one system that is reasonably common in Pashtun areas is sort of the Pashtunwali system of honor. It's a conflict resolution approach, which isn't about crime or punishment. It's about finding ways for people to keep living together. So it's not about he stole my goat, so he's going to give me back my goat and go to prison. It's about he stole my goat, so maybe there's something, and he already cooked it and ate it, but maybe there's something he can give my family that will make up for it and let us all live in the community. The problem is that women and girls are often offered as chits in this system. They tend to be what is given to somebody to replace that goat. And oddly, and this is not some of the low-scale surveying that people I know have done, talking to women in different areas, women disproportionately dislike the Pashtunwali system. When they're asked what sort of justice systems they prefer, they like Sharia legal systems, they like things that are coded. They don't like this conflict resolution system that's about let's make a deal, because they know that they're not the people making the deal. So what this fundamentally comes down to is not integrating women's rights into a broad range of efforts because it's too hard. Because you could argue that security comes first, so I need to get this done, so I'll worry about women's rights later. Another argument that's actually made in this context is that pushing for women's rights is destabilizing, that it could be a problem in and of itself. And the 60s, 70s, and 80s, which Catherine's book about, are often raised in this, that, you know, they tried to push too hard, too fast on women's rights, and look what happened. And I think the key point we need to take from that period is that doesn't really hold up to examination. They pushed a lot of things in those decades that weren't popular. I'm going to say that land reform probably angered a lot more people than getting some girls into school. So if this stuff continues, the marginalization of women will persist. And it'll prevent effective development for the reasons I outlined before about the very important impact of empowering women and girls economically and politically for development. It also has an impact in the near term. So women police. It's really hard to get women to sign up to be in the police force. It's really, this is at the Jalalabad Women's Center, the Jalalabad Training Academy. They've got room for 20 people to stay overnight. When I visited, they had 8 women training there. None of them were staying overnight. They were all staying with friends or family in the city. It was one of those cases of not having thought through whether people would let young women go and live in barracks in Jalalabad. They let them do it in Kabul. they don't want them to do it in Jalalabad. So there are people who say, you know, why are we bothering with this? I had a police trainer tell me, you know, you have all these ideas about domestic violence programs, but first you've got to get the police to stop robbing and killing people themselves before you can worry about domestic violence. Well, here's the thing. If you don't have women in uniform, you have nobody who can search people in burqas at border crossings, at buildings that you're trying to secure. You can't investigate crimes that involve women. I talked to a female border police officer in Jalalabad who hadn't taken a day off in months. She used to be able to take a day off because there was another woman working with her, but there was an IED attack, and that woman was badly injured, and she hasn't been able to come back to work. So the woman I spoke with was there every day because she was the only person at this very important, very busy border crossing who could search people wearing burqas or headscarves. The bottom line here is to, and to echo what Catherine said in her closing, is that if efforts to secure and develop a country only focus on one half of its population, those efforts will at best be slow, and at worst they will backfire. We need to not look at setbacks for women in Afghanistan as simply a sad effect of war and conflict. We need to recognize them as undermining the broad scope of our efforts to make things better in that country, and in that way, to make all of us in the United States and around the world safer as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Olga Oleiker. Wow, I'm suddenly tall, first time. Listen, we're going to ask you to ask questions in just a minute, but I want to remind our listening audience that they're listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our topic is Remembering Afghan Women with Catherine Brown and Olga Oleiker. And so now I turn the tables on you, and you can start asking questions. Carol has a microphone there, so please raise your hand, and she'll bring the microphone to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I thought the presentations were excellent. I think the only thing I took exception to was when you said it's harder than it looks. Well, it looks awfully hard. I mean, it's hard to imagine it being harder than the picture you've painted. But the question I have, I thought it was very, very helpful to look at the regional differences, talking about the capital is one thing and the regions are much different. I wonder if you could talk about that in percentage terms. I mean, what percentage of the people are living in major cities where women, you really can have access to women, and what percentage are living in very remote areas where it's really probably unrealistic to think you're going to get them in the near term? And then in response to that, what are your priorities? In other words, if you had access to funding, what would you do first, second, and third to take on these problems in kind of a systematic way?
So, proportionally, the majority of the country is rural. So, the Helmand, you know, province, while at an extreme, you know, I would imagine that most of the country more closely examines that than the major urban population centers like Kabul and Jalalabad, Herat, Mazar-e-Sharif, and Kandahar. So, I'm sorry I don't have specific percentage breakdowns, but I would imagine when you think about Afghanistan and the challenges that our development in aid workers and diplomats and troops are dealing with, they're more likely to be in the more rural areas. The as of priorities, definitely I always look at, and I've been taught this by my former colleagues at the Asia Foundation, that first it's security, it's addressing violence against women. It's ensuring that, you know, women have a safe home, not just a safe neighborhood and safe city to be in. And then it's education and training for so they can produce their own economic livelihoods. And that leads to political participation, to giving women a secure place to move from and actually then changing their own environments around them. So that's kind of the priority. If I were a women's empowerment practitioner, which I'm not, I would emphasize. And then if Olga has.
Just a couple of quick points. One is you are seeing increased urbanization in Afghanistan, as you are around the world, but you are still seeing a tremendous amount of poverty. I agree with Catherine. I think She has put security first in a very different context, which is human security. It's the security of the individual, the security of every human being to have the life that they would like to have, to be able to live free from fear. I think it's a very important concept. It's one that governments tend to have a difficult time taking on because governments tend to think about the security of governments. And, you know, one of the ways that I've put this to people is, you know, the average family, if their child is killed, whether their child is killed by a stray bullet or their child is killed by bad water, they're going to blame the government for not protecting them. So I think that is a very important point. That said, I mean, I think Afghanistan needs a mass literacy campaign, a good socialist-style mass literacy campaign where you gather up people and you send them into the countryside, you train them to teach, you train the teachers to teach other teachers, and you get this going. Because right now we're doing it in dribbles and drabs through NGOs that are following the Ministry of Education's program, which requires everyone to sit in the classroom for a couple, you know, 6 to 9 months at a time. This is in a place where most people haven't been to school. That's not going to work. But if you look at countries that have done this, that have actually gotten populations literate, Cuba in the 1960s, the Soviet Union in Central Asia, which you know, doesn't look that different from Afghanistan still, in the 1930s. They didn't teach everyone to a college level, but they got them to the point that they could read and they could write and they could sign their names and they could figure out if the land that belonged to them really did belong to them. And I think that, you know, that's my hobby course on Afghanistan. And I don't know that that's something that can be done with funding because the Afghan government has to do it. So that's the problem with that. It's not a question of where the development dollars should go. It's a question of where the Afghan government should put its priorities.
We have a group here of American women and gentlemen who are very interested in Afghanistan and their development, women's empowerment. What can we do? What is our role in helping their empowerment and their future development? I'm interested in or have Women for Women program, Greg Mortensen's school program, etc. Grameen Bank, those.
Yes, those are all excellent initiatives and ones that have proven to be very, very effective in the field. I think that supporting microcredit programs and programs that push educational literacy, as Olga just emphasized, are excellent places to start. I think that also it's keeping this issue in our national discourse, which is extremely important, and really thinking about what this will mean, that it's not so black and white when it comes to this war, and really thinking, you know, about women's rights and women's participation in any kind of reconciliation process. And so staying as vocal about this issue as you can while simultaneously, you know, continue to support these very worthy organizations that are working throughout Afghanistan. And the Asia Foundation is doing work, very important work on education and women's empowerment, political participation as well. So there's a variety of different groups that you can support. All of them have done incredible work. It's a great question, though.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I'm curious to hear your comments about what do Afghan women look at people like you working mm-hmm. there, and what the men look at you, and what do the government look at you for all this work? I mean, and what's your challenge mm-hmm. living there? What is the pleasure of you to stay there?
What's the reaction?
How do people react to us?
React to Western aid workers?
I think we can. Look, there's a wide variety of responses as there are people. I think most Afghan government officials, most Afghans who are educated, they're used to it. Either they grew up as educated Afghans with their own mothers and sisters being educated and professional, or they didn't, and they came into these positions, but they've seen enough Westerners by now that, you know, they'll deal with it. They may think it's terrible, they may think it's anathema, but, you know, what are they going to do about it? Most of the Afghan women I've met, both educated ones and less so, I don't know, maybe I'm fooling myself, but they seem pleased to see me. They seem to like talking to a woman. And most of the men, you know, honestly, I've interviewed boys undergoing police. I mean, I say boys. They are all supposed to at least be over the age of 18, or they'd be in violation of child soldier laws. But I've talked to them. They don't seem to have a problem answering my questions. I've never had anyone refuse to speak to me because I'm female at any level of society in Afghanistan.
Just to add to that, there's a saying over there in the international community that Western women kind of represent a third gender in Afghanistan, in the sense that they are, or, you know, the other way to put it, which some people say is you're an honorary male, which I was referred to as quite often. And in that sense, what they mean is that you are able to work with both men and women. So when I was a diplomat there, the first time I was there, I was able to do things my male colleagues could never do because I was able to work with both men and women. One of the things that that the military, especially the Marines, have realized is that in a lot of their counterinsurgency efforts, you know, in the same way that Olga was talking about, there needing to be Afghan women police and soldiers to check other women. Well, we need women Marines out there to build trust in the communities and to show women out there that they're not alone. This is not a male-dominated force, even though it is. There's only about, you know, I think 80 women Marines who are actually doing this work. But I think, you know, women are incredibly surprised. They're, you know, delighted. And when you go into more rural areas to see women in uniform and to see long hair under helmets, and they feel connected somehow. And so, and they're grateful that they can interact and share, you know, their problems directly to other women. So it's a mixed bag. You know, there's always going to be difficulty in being taken seriously, and, you know, everything depends on the person. But the third gender is something that tends to ring true.
And not just
there.
In Afghanistan.
Not just there, yeah.
Thank you. I have really two questions, and the first one's fairly specific. It's about Sarah Chase. I wonder if you know her, if she's still there, if she's still making soap, what's going on. And then the second question is about Greg Mortensen. Mm-hmm. Ever since I read his book some years ago, I thought, okay, this guy's on the right track, even though it seemed to me often our government was not. Over the weekend, I learned apparently his book is now required reading for our military, or many in our military, and I thought, well, that's the first bit of optimism I've had in some time, because I've felt from the beginning he was on the right track, and I'm wondering if you're also optimistic about people adopting his understanding of the Afghan people.
Do you want to speak to that? I can talk a little bit.
I can start. I don't know Sarah Chase. I've read her book. I know a lot of people who know her. I don't believe she's in Afghanistan right now.
She goes in and out.
Yeah, she's in and out. But look, the concept of counterinsurgency, as we keep relearning war after war, is that you have to secure the population, you have to deal with the population. It is basically human security, as Catherine described it. And that's what this is about, right? And in Afghanistan, a lot of it is understanding how Afghans approach these issues, and that it, you know, taking your time with it, working with communities. And I think that's difficult for Americans, especially American military personnel, to take on, because we're impatient, because the U.S. military does select for the can-do attitude, which is not about I'm going to sit here and wait and talk to you and talk to you some more and come back. It's about, okay, you know, what do we need to do? How do we do it? Okay, done. Let's move on to the next thing. So I think it's important, you know, the more resources you have, the more things you can read, the more actual Afghans you talk to. You know what? I'd rather they stop reading all those books and actually get out and talk to more Afghans sometimes, because I swear, you talk to some of the people in the senior leadership, and they travel in armored vehicles across the country, and then they don't stop and then have a meeting with an Afghan, which I at least do. They just keep on driving, and then they circle around, and then they're back and their base. I think that the people who can really teach Americans and Brits and Australians and Canadians about what Afghanistan is like are Afghans.
Absolutely. I agree. I think that for Sarah Chase, she's very well respected. And she's in Anau, and her book as well, Punishment of Virtue, is required reading, I believe. Three Cups of Tea has made a big impact in regards to how the military approaches the Afghan population. And, you know, the counterinsurgency, as Olga just said, it's a population-centric approach. It's really encouraging soldiers to dramatically change how they've been trained before and to learn, you know, to get outside of the vehicles, take their helmets off, put their guns down, and walk through and speak with Afghans. This is part of, I spent a lot of time at the counterinsurgency training center, they call it the COIN Academy in Kabul, and they're this summer, and they're really drilling that into soldiers, is that this is a new kind of warfare for Americans. It's not new for other countries, but this is very new for what we've been doing. So a lot of people are learning from Greg Mortensen that it does take time. It takes those three cups of tea, sometimes 18, you know, to really get anywhere and to really build trust. So it has had a very positive effect. And a lot of those trailblazers in the beginning, when no one was paying attention, you know, to this region, you know, their work and them speaking about their experience has been extremely valuable to what's going on now.
Hi. So I know that a lot of donors and international aid organizations frequently like to work with local NGOs and organizations in the country that they're in. And I was wondering if you could talk about if this is the case in Afghanistan also, and where you see as sort of the areas of potential or where you see capacity with civil society in terms of trying to address some of these problems.
Absolutely. I mean, all development gets done that way. I mean, that's how we do it as a country. That's how most countries do it. Afghanistan, actually, we were talking about this before this panel began, presents this problem. The high illiteracy levels, the very low levels of education, make it difficult to find partners, which means that some of the same people end up doing everything. And that is a real problem. Mm. It's a great challenge. And there isn't an easy solution for it other than education and getting more people up to the standards you need them to be at that you can work with them. You know, being illiterate doesn't mean you're stupid, right? It just means you haven't had opportunities. These people do know how things work in their countries. They maybe don't speak English, so they can't communicate it to you. They can't read and write, so they can't write it down and send you a nice, neat report about it. But they know this stuff. So I guess the other thing in addition to educating them, it's educating us so that we can speak to them more effectively. So we've got the people who know their language and can talk to them and can work with people who don't speak our own language. I guess that's the other problem. In addition to just working with literate Afghans, we tend to work with Afghans who speak very good English.
Yeah. Hi. So question for you. I'm actually a few generations Afghani, and I'm Muslim as well. So Islamic law actually has a lot of rights for women. Yes. So I'm just curious how in Afghanistan, how are they reconciling like Sharia and how they're treating women, and are they invoking that more now as a mechanism to have more rights because it's more of a democratic society at this level, I suppose. So I'm just curious.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Some really preliminary research that I read, actually, where the women did say they didn't like Peshtunwali, they liked Sharia. That was why, right? They understood Sharia law. They may not have actually understood Sharia law, but they understood that it guaranteed them certain rights and privileges, and that it did treat them as citizens, if not perhaps equal citizens, and that was preferable to other systems. I think we all know, I mean, the Taliban claims that what they do is Sharia law, but it's not, right? It's not what would be accepted by most scholars, by most Islamic legal scholars. And there's a lot of misinterpretation of Sharia throughout the country. The low levels of education, again, this is part of the problem. People, you know, that's another thing they're not educated about. And they go out, whether they're poorly educated about formal legal systems or traditional legal systems, they then go out and they practice, and that has detrimental effects across the country. An interesting anecdote, not from Afghanistan, from, I think, Kyrgyzstan. Somebody told me Kyrgyzstan has you have a choice, as you do in many places, of using the formal legal system or using one of the traditional systems. And a friend of mine was telling me that he spoke with a judge there who was actually empowered to do any of the above. And the judge told him that, you know, so I asked them, do you want the traditional system? Do you want this decided through the traditional system? Do you want it decided through Sharia, or do you want this decided through Kyrgyz law? And then they tell me what they want, and I do whatever I was going to do anyway. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of that.
Mm-hmm. Hi. I had a question about your comment about the literacy levels in the country holding back opportunities to get more people involved in helping the solution. What role do Afghan people who live in this country, who've left Afghanistan or have moved to United States, Europe, other places, what are these communities doing to assist in the country?
Sure. I've worked with a lot of Afghan Americans who've gone back to help in different capacities, either through women's empowerment, education, health, to develop better, you know, democratic governance. My old boss, Salma Khalilzad, is Afghan American, and he went back as U.S. ambassador. I know that the Fremont community, where a lot of, you know, Afghans are living, that there's a lot of fundraising work that's done. There's a few different boutique charities that go over and, you know, focus on specific projects. And that's usually, unless you're part of an institution or you're part of a larger NGO, I mean, choosing one thing that you can control and make an impact on is usually the best way to go. So I think that there's a lot of small organizations. There's like the Afghan Friends Network that was created here by an Afghan woman, Humaira Gilzai, that I used to work with when I lived here. So there definitely is help. I think I don't know exactly how many are currently in country, but I've worked with plenty of Afghan Americans who've gone back and served. A lot of the youth, a lot of people who grew up as Americans, were raised here, but have an Afghan heritage, have gone back and made a really important contribution. I can't give concrete examples though.
There are actually a ton of them working as interpreters.
Yeah.
All over the country. It's a great way for a lot of people to do some work and, you know, get back to their homeland. And you meet a lot of young people who are American who are working as interpreters, you know, or Afghan American working as interpreters there. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your presentation. I went to Afghanistan as a traveler 2 years ago, and what I'm curious about is who's doing anything about changing the attitude of men, because the women are not going to get empowered until the men change their attitude.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And it really is the most oppressive country for women that I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if people are addressing the men issue.
Right. I mean, gender equity is very much, you know, an education process for men as it's about women, about their own rights. So a lot of awareness work and, you know, saying the Sharia is not to oppress women, and really educating what the Constitution about, what Sharia law is about, is very much focused towards men. But this is something that is going to take some time, and it needs sustained efforts, you know, that they're constantly have these awareness campaigns. One statistic that is very interesting is that about 75% of the country is under the age of 25. And so you have a huge youth population. Depending on how you look at it, that's a great amount of opportunity, or that's something to fear, because if these kind of patterns of gender inequality continue, then you're going to have a whole new generation of people, of youth, you know, that think that this is okay to treat their wives and daughters this way. So there needs to be more focus, you know, on the youth component. But you're absolutely right. That's a huge part of any women's empowerment work that is done, is awareness, not just for women, but for men as well.
Thanks for your presentation. I'm not even sure how to ask this question exactly. I think as you see the American public turning against the war in Afghanistan, I think what they focus on, their knowledge of it, is based on the battles and the strategy of the army. You're involved with the civil society part of it, changing attitudes. How do you judge your success? How do you know? I mean, mm-hmm. how do you hang in there, in a sense?
Mm-hmm.
It's a really tough question. And, you know, I'll be honest with you. I have days where I don't think it's working. But, you know, here's what happens. Every time I do go out there and I talk to young people, men and women who are there, you know, that border police officer, right, who's going to work every day, I mean, she's putting her faith in something being built. And I do think we have an obligation to try to help put it there. We have an obligation to do better in how we do it. We do need to be much more careful about civilian casualties. We do need to be much better about getting the right messages out. We need to be much, much better about integrating the rights of women into everything we do. Otherwise, it will fail. I mean, I don't think it's a done deal that we're doing it all well. But I do think we owe something to these people. And we owe them figuring out how to do it better.
Just to add to that, I first arrived there 7 years ago, and things were drastically different in regards to the sense of hope that was very palpable there. And it was incredible watching women line up to cast their first vote for president in 5,000 years. And it was amazing to build these women's empowerment centers all around the country and to go celebrate their ribbon cuttings. You really did see that change. What I've seen is, since then, are things plateauing. You know, it's just, you know, things kind of, funding has stopped in certain areas, things that they thought, you know, the international community thought was successful no longer get funding. One of those areas that I focus on is media development and journalism, where I get very frustrated, you know, seeing how things have taken a turn security-wise and how, you know, some things have not progressed as quickly as I would like. But then I see how robust the media has become and how much Afghans have really embraced freedom of speech and how many thriving Afghan women journalists there are. And to me, that's definitely progress, and that's hope, and that's something that I hold on to.
It's in Kabul.
Well, it's in Kabul. It's also, there's a lot of journalists in Herat and in Mazar, and then, yeah, it's definitely in the north and the west, but it is something that I hold on to as a possibility.
Time for one last question. And it comes from me. So tell us, that Time magazine cover. Are we being manipulated? It's being used by people both for the war and opposed to the war. What is the meaning? What are we supposed to take away from this?
Well, I know the journalist who wrote the story, Erin Baker. She's phenomenal. She's been in that region for years. She knows the issues extremely well. She's she's has an excellent reputation. And I think what she was trying to do was show this very real moral dilemma that exists and trying to put it back into our national discourse. And I think she did a great job doing that. Now, being a media scholar, you know that journalists never pick their headlines or the pictures that accompany. So I don't know, I can't speak, you know, to really what the intention was in choosing the cover and putting that title without a question mark. You know, they said, what happens if we leave Afghanistan? There was no question mark after it. It was just saying, this is what's going to happen. But for me, you know, as I open with, and as we both spoke to, is that, you know, women have been used as a symbol for both sides of this war. I can absolutely see how people thought it was manipulating. But I think the content of the piece was very real and was based on a lot of research and her very extensive knowledge about Afghanistan.
Of course you're being manipulated. look, that's what Time magazine is trying to manipulate you to buy issues of their magazine, hopefully get a subscription. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it's almost ridiculous to put that picture on the cover and say, what happens if we leave, because this happened while we were there.
Exactly.
So, but it does, as Catherine said, it draws attention to an important issue. And instead of, you know, just focusing on the photograph, you can focus on the article and the issues that it raises and discusses. And I think that is still a useful thing.
I'd like to thank our two speakers, Catherine Brown and Olga Oleicher. I think we all like to thank them, not just for their presence, but for the hard work they're doing on this important topic. Also want to thank... Go ahead. I want to thank our three sponsors, the ASIA Foundation, the ASIA Society of Northern California, and the Truman National Security Project. I'd like to thank Carol, Lillian, and Sylvie for their work as the committee members. But I also want to thank, this is the last program I'm doing this year for the Asia-Pacific Forum. I want to thank Cynthia Miyashita, who's been working. She's the head of this committee, and she's been working for a number of years, a decade perhaps, close to that. Well, bringing about 8 to 10 to 12 programs a year, gratis, free, based upon her desire to do what this Commonwealth Club is all about, informing the population. So I'd like to recognize her at this moment. And thank you, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is now adjourned.